So Leadership in the Local Church is a series that we're going to start here today. And just want to start off with a little illustration here. We elect public officials to office for a variety of reasons. For example, in no particular order, I got 10 things here. And by the way, all the illustrations are dated in that way. I don't get in trouble with politics. First reason we vote them in is because their stated agenda or their objective. Like Herbert Hoover back in 28, a chicken in every pot and a car in every garage. We elect them because of their gender or because of their race. That's increasingly becoming a reason why people vote, especially for political office. Our ability to influence them. I love this quote by a guy named Ronald Steele. The perfect candidate is a nice guy who would never challenge the conventional wisdom and would like to lead us if only we would be so kind as to tell him where we want to go. Man of conviction. Here's a fifth reason. We're not voting for someone, we're voting against someone. We want the lesser of two evils. And if you think that's recent and all that, 1948 presidential campaign slogans, fool you on Dewey, and to err is Truman. So that's nothing new. Number six, their personal appearance, their popularity, or their charisma. Got a great quote here from Richard Nixon after his first debate with John F. Kennedy. He says, I blew it. He says, I spent so much time preparing substance for this debate, and I didn't pay enough attention to how I looked and how I presented myself, because John F. Kennedy was our first, TV president? Number seven, their party affiliation, right? Some people, no matter what, are going to vote Democrat, Republican, Independent, whatever. We vote that way. Single issue voting is another reason, right? To go to war, stay out of war. The economy, the ecology, abortion, right to life, those kind of things. Here's a new one. We vote for a candidate because of who they're going to appoint to the Supreme Court and federal judges. You know, in a world today where Congress isn't legislating and tossing it over to the court, that's getting to be a reason why we vote for certain people. And here's number 10, because of a candidate's name or status. And we're going way back to 52, I like Ike. And then for re-election, I still like Ike. And I wanted to use that because we got a little Ike running around the church here. He's over in Children's Church right now, I think. So those are reasons why that we may or may not vote for a presidential or other candidate for public office. But I'll tell you what, right now, these are not the reasons. These 10 reasons, or probably some similar ones to that, those are not reasons why we select a person for office in a local church. And we're not left to wonder, why, what's the basis? What's the criteria? Where do we get this understanding? We just read it. 1 Timothy chapter 3, Titus chapter 1 are two of the best places to go. God is very clear about the criteria for leaders in the local church. And first and foremost, they are spiritual qualifications. It doesn't say that elders and deacons must be successful businessmen, professional people, from prominent families or prominent in the community. That's often the case, especially in larger churches. I think the voting advice I got from my friend Al Johnson fits here too. He says, when I look for a political candidate, I look for the most moral man, most godly man I can find. What's the candidate's the criteria for being an elder or a deacon in the church? We're talking about godly characteristics, spiritual characteristics. So I don't know how long we're going to be here to get through these 13 verses, 7 verses. The first 7 verses are for elders, the next 6 for deacons. We took 2 Sundays for the role of women in the church, so it wouldn't be right to take less than 3. We'll do at least 3. We'll see how far we go on that. If you have your message insert, try to give you the big picture. The outline for the 13 verses, the rough outline is there so you can get a feel for where we're going, if that's the kind of thing that's important to you. It's important to me. Maybe it is to you. I don't know. So we're going to get here and get started with the spiritual qualities for elders. Essentials for elders. First one, his personal aspiration. It's a trustworthy statement. If any man desires or aspires to the office of overseer, that word overseer is the word bishop. It's interesting, in the New Testament, we have different terms. We have overseer, bishop, elder. They're almost synonymous terms. They're almost used interchangeably in the New Testament. When we see the early New Testament church, there were a plurality of elders. In other words, there were more than one elder in the overall church. But more than that, we see a plurality of elders in the local church, more than one. And to me, an elder isn't just the pastor. A pastor is an elder who is vocationally called to lead. But an elder can be a lay person in the church, whether you're compensated for that or you have another job. Typically, there's a plurality. Acts 20:17, Paul said, from Miletus he sent to Ephesus and called him the elders of the church. What's it say in James 5:14 is, if anyone sick among you, then he must call for the elders of the church. It's interesting, the constitution that we have here at Nevins Lake doesn't have the word elder in it. The recognized leaders of the church are pastor, deacon, trustee, and then Sunday school superintendent and clerk. And I don't think the absence of the word elder in our constitution means that the pastors, Pastor Tim and I, are the only elders here at the church. And that was kind of an assumption. You know, we got to be careful when we make assumptions. So I got that constitution out. I wanted to see what the constitution had to say about the responsibilities or duties for deacons and trustees. And if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to read those for you, because I think it's important, because I don't want you to get the impression that Pastor Tim and I are the only elders here in the church. We're the pastors who've been called to vocational ministry, but I don't think we're the only elders, and I don't think our constitution means that for us to operate that way. Deacons. In addition to their duties as a board member, the deacon's foremost duty is to assist the pastor in visiting the sick and sorrowing of the membership, and to endeavor to remedy any spiritual weakness in the lives of the membership. They should, by God's grace, live and serve in conformity to the standards set in 1 Timothy 1-13. The only thing it doesn't say is able to teach. Trustees, to me, deacons in our constitution really are elders, and trustees are really deacons. In addition to their duties as board members, the trustees shall oversee the regular operational and maintenance functions of the church. So I want to get that out of the way right up front, that this isn't just a message about me and Pastor Tim, that every local church has a plurality of elders, paid and lay people. So the desire for an elder, it's a fine work, it's a noble work he desires to do. Paul says it's a trustworthy statement. I don't know if that was a popular saying in that time or not, but he's saying this is a self-evident statement. It's true. Everyone knows it's true. That if a man desires to be an elder, he desires a good thing, a good work. The NIV says if anyone sets his heart on being an elder, not for what he can get, but for what he can give. So where does that desire come from? Well, it should come from the Holy Spirit. To be called to be a pastor, elder, it becomes something that a man must do. Nothing else will do. I became a pastor later on in life, you know that. Even though I went to Bible college right out of high school, I served a number of terms as deacon and elder at Whitneyville Bible Church back in the day. And then I began to have this growing desire to be a pastor. And I couldn't shake it. From the time I knew or sensed that God was calling me to be a pastor was at least 5 years. So it wasn't like a quick little process. Besides all that, I knew I wasn't ready. I was really rough, really rough. A lot of rough edges, young, immature Christian. But I also had some words running around in my head from my preaching teacher, my homiletics teacher, Ken Hasper, who's with the Lord now. And I've never forgotten it. If you can do anything else besides preaching and be happy and contented, do it. Unless you have a burning desire to preach, you don't belong. And I got there. And I understand exactly what he was saying. The desire to be a pastor, to be an elder, isn't for a life of ease. It says it's a fine work. It's a noble task. The King James says he desires a good work. You keep hearing the word work, don't you? To be a servant of the Lord as an elder in the church requires labor. It involves work, or at least it should. The calling of an elder. It's for men only. The language is very specific. The husband of one wife, the man of one woman. You look at the original language there, it's masculine all the way. Titus 1:6 confirms this. The husband of one wife. Verse 4 talks about an elder managing his own household well. Who ran the households? Who were the head of the households in those days? It was always the men. And then when we looked in the 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 12, about the roles of the women in the church and things they were called to and things they were not called to, we have, but I do not allow a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man, but to remain quiet. So God calls men, and those who desire to be an elder desire a good thing, a good work, but just because a person, a man, has that desire isn't enough. God's the one who selects. The church agrees. The church observes the man and sees whether or not God has selected him or not. But it's not like this election process, even though sometimes it comes down to it in our church government here. 1 Timothy 5:2 is a very sober warning. 1 Timothy 5:22. Do not lay hands upon anyone too hastily and thereby share responsibility for the sins of others. Keep yourself free from sin. In other words, church, you better do your homework. You better see if this person has been called by God, that they have the spiritual qualifications to serve in the capacity they're called to, and they have the ability to do that as well. It's a warning. Our text here helps us to determine if a man is called by God to be an elder. Very serious thing. Leaders, this is something I learned at Bible school and I've never forgotten. It's scary. Leaders can't bring anyone further than they themselves have gone. They used to tell us, and you know, I'm a 17, 18-year-old kid at the time, you set the standard. Probably no one in the church is going to go further in their walk for Christ or their service than you do. No one's going to be more faithful in their walk for Christ, perhaps, than you are. Very serious, who we call. This text that we have is a means for a man to determine whether he has the qualifications, but it's also a means for the church. This isn't some kind of fuzzy, emotional thing out there. They're very specific things here for us. They're inward qualities. They're spiritual qualities, moral qualities for the man. But they express themselves in the life that he lives. And though we may not know what's on the inside, what do we know? Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. And an elder, a man who says, I feel called to be an elder, I feel called to be a pastor, will have those qualities within that we can observe on the outside. Verses 2 and 3 are his character description. That's where we're going to be today. I don't know if we'll get through verses 2 and 3. I've kind of divided verses 2 and 3. It kind of looks like a grocery list. I'm not going to preach it like a grocery list. By the grace of God, I won't do that. But to me, when I look at verse 2, it's all positive stuff. These are the things that should be in the life of a man called to be an elder or pastor. But we get to verse 3, it's not completely, but more, it's like these things shouldn't be there. An overseer then must be. We see that here in verse 2. It's also in verse 4. It's also in verse 7. An elder must be these things. First of all, he must be above reproach. He must be blameless. Literally means nothing to take hold on. He's irreproachable. It means to be without blame, without criticism, above criticism. Certainly doesn't mean he's never sinned, because we've all sinned, right? This particular first thing on the list might be a general statement. Not exactly sure. It might be like the top reason, or it might be a general statement, and the things that come after are specifics that tell you how the elder is to be blameless, how they're supposed to be above reproach. Any way you look at it, it's number one on the list. I got this quote, I can't remember where it's from. An elder that isn't blameless will not be able to discharge his duties because he's grieved the Holy Spirit by his sin, and he doesn't have the confidence, the support of the people in the church. Then we get to verse 7, in the community. Next thing, an elder must be the husband of one wife. The husband of one wife. Doesn't say the elder or pastor has to be married. The Apostle Paul wrote this. 1 Corinthians 7:8, he said, "But I say to the unmarried and to the widows that it's good for them if they remain as I." He was unmarried. 1 Corinthians 9:5, "Do we not have the right to take along a believing wife, even as the apostles and the brothers of the Lord?" And so we get the understanding, even though we're not told, that the apostles were married, but not Paul. But you don't have to be married. That's not what it's saying, the husband of one wife. Something else here. This is not talking about divorce and remarriage in terms of a pastor. I mean, there are other places that talk about that. But I'll give you my position. I believe there is such a thing as an innocent party in a divorce. And I believe if a pastor or an elder is the innocent party in a divorce, they have the right to remarry just like everyone else. There are those who would say a divorced man is not fitted. He's no longer qualified to be a pastor or an elder. That's not my position, but that has been a long-held position by many. It was by the IFCA for a number of years. Warren Wiersbe kind of states this in his commentary, that particular position. A pastor who has been divorced opens himself and the church to criticism from outsiders, and it is not likely that people with marital difficulties would consult a man who couldn't keep his own marriage together. He says, "I see no reason why dedicated Christians who have been divorced and remarried cannot serve in other offices in the church, but they are disqualified from being elders or deacons." That's the hard line. The IFCA that we belong to defers to the local church in their position, whether they call a divorced pastor or elder. They don't say anything. And the IFCA itself doesn't even have a hard and fast policy. It used to be if you wanted to become a member of the IFCA, if you were divorced, no. Yeah, you're denied. I went online to check the statement that's there now. That's not true. They examine every person by a number of different criteria on a case-by-case basis. There's no this way or that way. That's it. To me, the question hinges on this. Is the man above reproach? Is he blameless or not? And there's a lot of things that go into that. Every person, every situation is unique, right? I will say this, though. When two people get a divorce, rarely is one person completely to blame. That's a pretty sobering thought. So let's move on. I just thought I needed to cover that a little bit. And if we want to talk about that some more, we could talk about it. And I certainly could do some more homework on that myself. But literally, husband of one wife means a one-woman man. That is, he is sexually faithful to one woman, his wife. And this rules out polygamy, right? That's out the door. That was common in Old Testament times. Husband of one wife. One woman at a time. I mean, a pastor may have legitimate reasons to marry. Certainly, if his wife passes away, he has every right, as anyone else, to get married. And he still may, even if he's divorced, have a right to get married. But did you notice the location of this one? If in fact an elder must be above reproach and then the specifics follow underneath it, what's the first one? The husband of one wife. The husband of one wife. Why? Why is that to the top? I think it's because a pastor or an elder who is unfaithful to his wife, sexually unfaithful to his wife, does the most harm to the Lord's name and to the ministry of the local church. Personally, I think it would be surprising to hear any adult in this room who couldn't say, well, I remember or I've heard of this pastor or this elder and they did this and this happened with them. It has the potential of doing the most harm, the most damage to the cause of Christ. So I think that's one of the reasons it's right up there. I think it's one of the reasons why, personally, I believe so many men fall into sexual sin. They're leaders, they're targeted by the enemy, and this gets a lot of traction with the lost. It says an elder must be temperate. The ESV says sober-minded. The Greek word has the idea of being alert, clear-headed. It literally means wineless. Not spineless, wineless. Clear, sensible judgment in all things. Nothing clouds their thinking. I like the way John Phillips describes this. He calls this wise caution. An elder understands what's happening and he acts rightly. Paul told Timothy, 2 Timothy 4 or 5, but you, keep your head in all situations. Keep your head on straight, Timothy. Know what you're getting into. Do your homework. There's a really good biblical example. If you would, turn with me to Acts chapter 5, verse 35. Acts chapter 5, verse 35. Gamaliel, however we want to say it, he's a great example of temperate behavior. The council, the Sanhedrin, they told the apostles, quit preaching, quit teaching, quit talking about Christ. You stop this. Of course, they didn't. And when they hauled them back in, the apostle said, we would rather obey God rather than obey you, and we're going to keep teaching. And they were all fired up, and they wanted to kill him. And then Gamaliel comes out with some very temperate advice. Verse 35. I got the right chapter. I have the wrong location written down in my notes. I'm not gonna try to find it right now. Let me just read it for you. I'll find that text here in a minute. Gamaliel said to the men of Israel, take care what you propose to do with these men. For some time ago, Theudas rose up claiming to be somebody, and a group of about 400 men joined up with him. But he was killed, and all who followed him were dispersed and came to nothing. After this man, Judas of Galilee, rose up in the days of the census and drew away some people after him, he too perished, and all that were with him were scattered. So in this present case, I say to you, stay away from these men and let them alone. For if this plan or action is of men, it will be overthrown. But if it's of God, you will not be able to overthrow them, or else you may be even found fighting against God. An elder must be temperate. I'm not saying Gamaliel was an elder, but I'm saying he is operating in a very temperate, clear-headed, rational thinking way. Very sober judgment to the religious authorities. An elder must be prudent. I love that word. Self-controlled, of sound mind. Balanced judgment, common sense. Elders are to take all the facts in before jumping to conclusions. Not talking about the paralysis analysis, because we're never going to have all the information we want, but take in and get all the information. Here's a real funny story I found about jumping to conclusions. There once was a kindergarten teacher who was celebrating a birthday, and a few of the children brought gifts to school for her. One little boy approached her with a long rectangular box. She knew his parents owned a floral shop, so the teacher smiled and said, I'll bet this is some pretty flowers. I love flowers. That's what it was. A little girl was next in line with her gift and handed the teacher a square box that was rather thick. Since her parents owned a candy store, the teacher said, I'll bet this is a box of delicious candy. And it was. Another little boy had a box that was not large, but still rectangular in shape. His parents owned a liquor store. As he handed his present to the teacher, she noticed that the bottom of the box was leaking, and she was concerned that something inside may have been broken or spilled. She ran her hand across the bottom of the wet box and licked her fingers. She looked at the young boy and said, "I'll bet this is a bottle of wine, isn't it?" His eyes widened as he answered, "No, ma'am, it's a puppy." My wife didn't want me to tell this. Elders are to be prudent, gathering all the necessary facts before making decisions, not jumping to conclusions. And of course, the decisions, the judgments that pastors and elders make are much more serious, right? Much more long-lasting. I don't know how many times I've talked to somebody and said, "Well, the pastor did this, or the pastor said that, or the elder of the church did this, and I'm never going to darken the door of a church again." It's really important how a pastor, an elder, deacons, the leaders of the church conduct themselves. Very serious. It can impact people for the rest of their lives, and often it does. An elder must be respectable. I can't get hung up on that word, respectable. I don't know why. Maybe because I don't feel respectable. To me, respectable almost has the idea of somebody playing a role. You know, I'm a pastor. I'm an elder, and I need to look and act a certain way. And it's like I'm thinking, no, just be real, you know? But I got it all wrong. The English word respectable has the idea of being morally above reproach. I like that. To be acceptable in appearance. But the Greek word goes a different direction than that. It has the idea of being orderly, to arrange. When we're in the section in 1 Timothy 2 about the role of women, that particular word was modest. But the whole idea behind the Greek word was orderly, arranged. You know, we would say she's put together, right? She's put together. For an elder, it means every facet of his life is in order. He's living a disciplined life. Kind of gives you the idea that they're an organized person. They follow through on their projects, their commitments. An elder, a pastor, is the kind of person that says, "I'll be there," shows up, and he shows up on time. And if they don't, they call ahead and they let you know. But they're known by people who keep their word. If they say they'll do something, they follow through and they do it in a timely way, to the best of their ability. An elder or a pastor who is respectable, whose life is orderly and arranged, doesn't have a lot of loose ends in it. It's in good order, in good biblical order in every way. Would you look at the time? I thought I was going to get a lot further. I think we're just going to wrap this up for now, and we'll take over the next time when it comes to hospitality. But I know whenever we talk about the qualifications for leadership in the church, there's two groups of people that are affected by this. And the first is the congregation. They say, like, "Oh boy, I'm free here. I mean, is this kind of some information that I kind of need to know? I'm going to be called on sometime to, you know, help select an elder or deacon for the church." But I got to tell you something. You get past able to teach, you get past the husband and one wife, the qualifications for elders and then for deacons in the church are no different than the spiritual qualities for all Christians. If I could put the difference this way, I would say an elder must have these things, and I would say a member of the congregation, a regular Christian, should have these things. If you're going to serve as a leader, there's no doubt you must have them. But all of us should have them. All Christians should have these qualities. They should be who we are. And there's another group, and I know this is a toughie, because I've been there. Every time I read the qualifications, I look at those and think, I know my heart. I know my mind. I know who I am. And God knows me even better. I don't live up to all that. Not all the time. I'm not qualified. And I know sensitive, humble men in the church who hear these will walk away from a message like this and say, I'm not qualified either. I can't do it. In fact, it might even be a current board member say, I got to resign today. I just want to let you know, we don't measure up, completely measure up all the time. We're sinners saved by grace. It's a great reminder, though. Remember, the standards are set by the leaders. Hopefully the people will measure up by God's grace, even exceed them. But we got to set the standards, and we have to know what the standards are. And it's very sobering to hear those.